afternoon. We'll call to order the House Committee on Rules for April 1st, 2013. We're going to have a few bills today on the first two items on the agenda are public hearings on initiative reform issues, and I am going to go up there and speak to them briefly as the chief sponsor. You want to explain what they
you
do?
You want to open public hearings on
Open public hearing on HJR 15 and HB 2543.
And members, House Bill 2543 modifies provisions relating to state initiative measures that require appropriation or expenditure of public monies. Requires before collection of signatures on an initiative petition, chief petitioner must submit to the Secretary of State estimate of appropriation or expenditure of public monies required if measure were to be enacted. Requires an estimate of sufficiency of new tax or fee or increase in rate of existing tax or fee be included as part of the measure if it requires appropriation or expenditure of public monies. If estimate is challenged for sufficiency, chief petitioner must prove revenue from the new or increased tax or fee is sufficient to cover immediate and future costs. Requires the ballot title of the state measure include as part of the statement. Statement identifying how much measure will be paid with a description of the new or increased tax or fee. Requires fiscal estimate committee to estimate amount of direct new tax or fee to be increased. Changes become effective only if House Joint Resolution 15 is approved at the next general election. And House Joint Resolution 15 proposes an amendment to the Constitution to require initiative petition proposing law or constitutional amendment with fiscal impact, also provide new tax or fee or increase in rate of existing tax or fee to cover immediate and future costs of law or amendment.
Vice Chairs, colleagues, Chris Garrett, State Representative, House District 38. Thank you for your attention to HJR 15 and the accompanying bill, which is the number that I don't have in front of me, but she just described it for you. This is an issue that has been before us in the last couple sessions. I intend to keep bringing
Chris,
it back.
A little closer.
Is it off?
Well, I couldn't hear you very well anyhow.
That's good.
Okay. I'll just hold the mic. I will keep bringing this HJR until we pass it or until I die. I feel that strongly about it. What this is about is applying to ourselves, the people, as we use the initiative process, the same requirements of fiscal discipline and responsibility that we, as the people's representatives, are held to in the legislative process. I'm not going to read all my testimony, although I would love it. But I guess I would start by saying that Oregonians who are concerned about growth in government spending need to look in the mirror. According to the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring in 2009, approximately 50% of new general fund and lottery spending since 1990 has been dictated by voter initiative. Initiatives add to government spending in addition by increasing the cost of borrowing. You have information from the Treasurer's office, and I believe somebody from that office will be speaking shortly about the impact that the initiative system has on our status with credit rating, bond rating agencies who view it as a fundamentally destabilizing influence. When we balance our budget here in this building, we have to make very difficult decisions about where to spend limited resources. Every year, we come in and find that we have a list of desires that exceeds our available revenues. And these decisions require us to evaluate how we tax ourselves, how and how much, how we spend our money, and how we structure state services. We make these decisions knowing that the solutions to Oregon's problems cannot be delayed and that our actions require difficult trade-offs. The initiative system operates without a trace of this fiscal discipline or accountability. Because we impose no subject matter limitations on initiatives, unlike most states, the same petitioner in the same election can propose simultaneously a measure to cut taxes and a measure to increase spending on popular programs. And there is no constitutional impediment to doing that, and there's not even an impediment on you or I in the privacy of our ballot making two fundamentally irreconcilable choices. Voters are invited to believe they can have something for nothing, encouraged to vote for popular policies like prison sentences without being given any information about the trade-offs and consequences that we know will follow from that. Furthermore, when an initiative asks only whether a voter likes a policy, you get a yes or no answer. But what critically we don't learn from a yes or no answer on a policy is how much a voter cares about it and how a voter would rank that policy on a list of budget priorities. As a result, initiatives don't, they may reflect a snapshot of public opinion on a policy question, but they don't tell us anything about how voters actually prioritize government services. Representative Hicks and I are dealing with this in the public safety arena. Voter-passed sentencing measures are causing prisons to eat up a growing share of the budget, even as recent polling tells us that Oregonians would actually rather spend less on prisons and more on crime prevention measures such as policing, drug and alcohol treatment, and mental health services. So if initiatives don't ask voters to rank priorities, the best way we have to evaluate how committed the petitioner and the voters are to a policy is to ask them the same questions that we have to deal with in this building. How much is it going to cost and how will you pay for it? That's the question that HJR 15 would require petitioners to answer. This may seem like a big change, and I would just close by pointing out something to the committee. Although we were the first to make significant use of the initiative system, and it's now called the Oregon system, some version of it was adopted by about 23 other states, very few of them went as far as we did. Most of the states that adopted the initiative system said, we like that, but a little less of that. And so they have, I've passed out a chart in front of you, shows you, I think it has all 50 states on there and what their systems are. About half the states don't have initiative process. Of the states that do, the vast majority have some kind of subject matter limitation. And of those, the most common limitation of subject matter is that you can't use an initiative to upset the state budget. So Oregon gave the initiative process its start. Other states have learned from us, and now I hope that we've learned something from them. And I will conclude my testimony there. I won't get into the House bill that's we've also opened a hearing on. It's really just a statutory implementation of what HJR 15 would require, which is a process for determining whether an initiative has, in fact, adequately paid for itself. Thank you. So I guess we have two other folks who'd like to testify. I'd like to invite Professor Norman Williams and Cappy Eaton forward to speak.
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Norman Williams. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University. While Willamette is my employer, I speak here solely in my own personal capacity, and my views don't necessarily reflect those of Willamette University one way or the other. I come here to speak in favor of HJR 15. I've submitted written testimony, so my remarks will be brief. As Chair Garrett very accurately pointed out, HJR 15 attempts to resolve a looming fiscal nightmare for the state of Oregon. Oregon voters can use the initiative process currently in order to mandate, either through constitutional initiatives or statutory initiatives, new public expenditures without actually having to identify the revenue to pay for those revenues. The likely consequence at some point in the future will be something of the sort that California has experienced for the past 25 years. California, like Oregon, has a very liberal, small L, direct democracy system in which it's very easy to get both constitutional amendments and statutory measures placed on the ballot and California voters have used their initiative power very frequently in ways that have severely exacerbated the fiscal situation in California. In fact, the story of California is a very kind of telling one because of what it might mean for here in Oregon if Oregon voters were to do likewise. The story of California begins in 1978, in which California voters adopt the very famous Proposition 13, which imposed severe caps upon property tax revenue. In California, most public education was funded through property tax revenue, and so the consequence of the passage of Prop 13 was to deprive California public schools of a great source of revenue. Over the next 10 years, predictably, the quality of California's public schools declined, and so in 1988, California voters, outraged at the quality of public education, passed ballot Proposition 98, which requires, it's a amendment to the California Constitution that requires the state to expend a certain percentage of state revenues on public education. In the 2013-2014 budget cycle, the California Legislative Analyst's Office anticipates that Prop 98 will require the state of California to pay $56.2 billion on K through 12 education in order to comply with Prop 98. To put that in context, this year's entire general fund budget in California is anticipated to be approximately $97 billion. So 57% of the state's general fund revenue is tied up through Prop 98. The consequence for California since the passage of Prop 98 has been a legislature that has a variety of other spending priorities and an inability to find general fund revenue to come with that, since the voters have mandated that the money be spent on public education, but yet capped the revenue sources. HJR 15 simply tries to address that problem and forestall Oregon going the way of California by requiring any initiative proponent here in Oregon who's come up with an idea that entails and mandates public expenditures to identify the funds for doing so, and thereby put Oregon voters in the position of knowing how much they're going to have to pay if they want the benefits of the program that they are going to pass. It's a pay-as-you-go system. Four other states already have pay-as-you-go systems, and those systems have worked well in other states by forestalling or preventing the type of fiscal calamity that California has experienced as a result of its inability to or failure to require its voters to identify funding sources for mandated, initiated expenditures. Thank you, Chair Garrett. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them now or after Cappy speaks.
Thanks for coming over. We'll hear from Cappy first and then take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Mr. Williams has put forth the case very succinctly for many years. The League has worked on this particular issue that really never has come up before. We started a couple of decades ago working on even getting a fiscal statement within the ballot measure of what the impact might be money-wise, but there was no guarantee, and in fact there was no requirement that that money had a source for spending that money. So this, to us, is the fruition of many years of efforts with other groups and interests about the fact that if you want to spend public money, you need to identify how the money is going to come into that proposal, whether it's a statute or whether it's a constitutional amendment. The League looks at constitutional amendments very closely. We don't we don't often support constitutional amendments unless we feel that they are very appropriate and very necessary. And we very strongly support HJR 15 because what the proposal is needs to go into the system. Some of you may recall former Senator Frank Morris used to talk about the tremendous burden on the general fund, and he did it over from 1990 through 2010, and he had a borough that represented the general fund, and then he took the various bundles of initiatives, and the burden grew to the point where the borough could no longer really serve the public. So we hope that you will very seriously consider and pass this statute and its accompanying constitutional amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Apparently not. Thank you both very much for your testimony. We do have two others, Leslie Johnson and Mike Salvaggio, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is this on? My name is Leslie Johnson. I am here as a private citizen to speak in support of reform of the initiative process, but my position is informed by my experience doing research for the City Club of Portland on the subject of Oregon's initiative referral and referendum system. I was a member of the study committee and chair of the subsequent advocacy committee charged with pursuing reforms within the scope of the 2008 report's conclusions and recommendations. I had the opportunity to testify before this committee in 2009 on this subject. You may recall that some not insignificant procedural reforms came out of that session. Those of us who spent 18 months or so working on this report like to think it can pretty much speak for itself. But I'm going to emphasize a couple of points for you. They'll be somewhat redundant of the other testimony but you're hearing, but I think it's worth it for the record. The City Club of Portland has taken up study of the initiative process twice now, first in 1996 and then with this 2008 report. On both occasions, I'm a little sorry to report, the impact of the initiative process on the state's finances was prominently featured in the final reports. The problem is fairly obvious. While the Oregon Constitution requires the state legislature to balance the state's budget each biennium, no such discipline is imposed on the proponents of an initiative which mandates spending or on those who vote in favor of such initiatives. Voters are free to mandate expenditures or revenue reductions without any responsibility for the financial consequences. In our 2008 report, we determined that mandating changes in revenue and expenditures through the initiative system disrupts the state's budgeting process, confounds the legislature's constitutional duty to balance the state's budget, and negatively affects state and local bond ratings. Our committee also concluded that financial disclosures in the context of an initiative campaign were not sufficient to assure well-informed choices by voters. And that's true even though we made some recommendations about tweaking or improving those disclosures, and those kinds of recommendations continue to come up. There's reason to believe that voters do not appreciate that initiative results tie up the legislature's budgeting process by mandating spending or restricting revenues that had been expected to be available for other purposes, and that subsequent initiatives may throw out of balance a previously balanced budget midstream. And that's reflected in the public's dissatisfaction or frustration with what the legislature can or cannot accomplish in terms of budgeting when it's actually in session. I think it's really critical for you to take that into consideration. We also learned in the 2007-2008 study process that the vulnerability of the state's budgeting cycle to
to unfunded mandates has materially affected Oregon's bond rating in the market over time. And that was a new subject for us in the more recent report. It had not been a subject of discussion about 10 years earlier. Oregon bonds are consistently rated low in relation to other state governments, at least in part because of the initiative and referendum system. At the time of our report, we quoted Moody's Investor Service, the bond rating agency, as consistently identifying voter initiatives as a credit negative for Oregon due to the fact that previously adopted initiatives, constraints on financial operations, and the threat of future initiatives injects an element of uncertainty into future operations. I can make copies of the 2008 City Club report available if there are any of you by any chance that haven't read it yet. I draw your attention to the sections at pages 26 and 28 focused on the impact on the budgeting process and the state's bond rating. While I am not in a position to offer a City Club position on the precise measures before you, I can say that efforts to temper the currently unfettered ability of initiative proponents to commit resources or limit revenues without commensurate responsibility for balancing the budget fall well within the scope of both of the reports previously adopted by the club and its members. The initiative referral and referendum process is always going to be part of the political process in Oregon, and it has proven useful to accomplish important changes in high-stakes political issues when the legislature is unable or unwilling to act. But states that adopted the initiative system after Oregon have learned some from our mistakes. When our committee finished its work in 2008, we had some pessimism because the subject matter restrictions that have been referred to in the earlier testimony that have been accomplished in other states were, as far as we could tell, always accomplished with an act of those later statutes. There may not yet have been a successful effort at this kind of reform, but I urge you to be optimistic. I want you to be brave because there's definitely room for improvement. Thank you.
I just want to thank you for coming down. I think this is a good example of how when people start to dive into this issue, they can become really committed to it. The City Club's 1996 report that Leslie mentioned is what got me interested in this when I was finishing up college. And now in two legislative sessions as a staffer and three as a legislator, I have fought the fight here. And Leslie, the report's now 5 years old that you worked on, but you're still here testifying. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come down. Mike, why don't you go ahead and we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. And while the State Treasury has not been able at this point to evaluate and review the legislation to the point where we can express support of this particular measure, I do want to convey conceptual support of providing a more comprehensive financial projection of proposed initiatives. And I'm just going to very briefly state some information regarding our some credit outlooks from the first quarter of this year. We received a document from Fitch and from Standard & Poor, both noting that the initiative process is an element that does contribute negatively to fiscal impacts. Standard & Poor notes that as one offset to the state's financial strengths, the current initiative process can restrict budgetary flexibility. Fitch notes that strong financial management is critical in the face of exposure to, it's a quote, voter initiatives with negative fiscal impact. Sadly, these are considered proprietary documents by the agencies. I am happy and currently trying to secure their permission to release them, but until then I'll ask that they're not entered into the record, and as soon as I do have that authorization, I'll get them to the committee. I
appreciate that, but it's fair to say that historically rating agencies have cited the initiative system as a negative in their assessment of our fiscal stability, right?
Representative Geer, members of the committee, my understanding is that's correct.
Right, thank you. Any questions? Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, so what does that mean, Mike, in terms of the, you know, the actual consequences to of this impact? I mean, does it result in a, you know, a measurably lower bond rating that translates into undesired consequences?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would always be loath to say that one single item is going to be the difference between one rating versus another rating. These decisions are the result of many, many variables and data points. And rather than saying, if this was changed, we would definitely be knocked up a notch, or if we had this other negative, we'd definitely be knocked down a notch, I would just say that there's variables in a positive column and variables in a negative column, and this historically tends to contribute to the negative column. And if I could further clarify, Mr. Chair, just for the record, this in no way implies the Treasury's support or opposition to the initiative system in general, which is a proud part of Oregon's history. I refer, of course, to the fiscal discipline that is either there or lacking, according to your view and to the rating agency's view.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate that. Thank you. All right. Thank you both. Appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on HJR 15 and HB 2543. And while Mr. Salvaggio is still here, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 18.
Members, Senate Bill 18 allows a Financial Estimate Committee to estimate financial impact of state measure on any federally recognized Native American or Indian American Indian tribal government. FEC may estimate amount of direct expenditure, direct reduction of expenditure, direct reduction in revenues, direct tax revenue or indebtedness, and interest resulting from enacting a state measure or not enacting a state measure. It does apply to Financial Estimate Committees required on ballot measures filed after January 1, 2014.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. Senate Bill 18 affects the Financial Estimate Committee, which
could
is...
Could you speak up a little bit?
Senate Bill 18 affects the state's Financial Estimate Committee, which is more commonly known as the Price Tag Committee. It has the responsibility of assigning fiscal impacts and explanations of those impacts onto ballot measures. These statements appear in the voter pamphlet statement and help provide vital information to voters about the cost of these measures and other financial effects. Currently, the Financial Estimate Committee is restricted in what it can actually describe in those summaries, and those restrictions are found in Chapter ORS 250, and they include a restriction to evaluate financial impacts on state government and on local government. And the Treasury feels that there is a gap in that there is no provision for evaluating impacts on tribal governments. So the Treasurer, as a member of that committee, has asked that we introduce this bill to give that committee the flexibility to offer more information to voters as to the effects of various ballot measures on our tribal governments.
Thank you. Any questions? Justin Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member, and I'm also very proud to represent the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance, where I am the association manager, and we are happy to be here. Thank you very much for hearing this, and thank you for giving us the opportunity with this piece of legislation. Now, you've got my written testimony in front of you today, so I won't take a lot of your time, but I would like to mention a few quick things on why this is so relevant to tribal governments throughout Oregon. In 2011, the direct economic contribution of tribal gaming throughout the state was $561 million in casino output. In 2011, tribal casinos employed an average of 5,056 people directly with a payroll of nearly $212 million. By comparison, the Oregon Lottery employed 446 people with less than a $36 million payroll. Tribal casinos and tribal governments supported gaming collectively had an economic impact totaling $1.5 billion in output, 13,153 jobs, and $506 million in wages and benefits to Oregon. As a result of a lot of these economic impacts, we were able, as tribal governments, especially in rural parts of the state, to actually diminish some of the burden on local governments, as well as county governments and city governments, by being able to provide the programs that you see there on the pie chart, programs that deal with health, education, housing, elder care, and elder pensions. And we worked very hard to do that, to be productive within Oregon. And as a lot of you know, in a lot of cases, we are the largest employers in and around those counties. So when it came time to fight a initiative about a private casino being located in Portland, I had to go in and go in front of the commission. We, collectively as tribes, had to go in front of the city initiative review committee and actually spend about 5 days educating those citizens that were chosen to do that. It was very difficult for us to do that job because we were not truly able to tell those citizens what the actual financial impact would be. So where a number was presented, say in this last cycle of $53 million net economic benefit to the state of Oregon, the reality was that it was a net loss because of the impact it did have throughout rural Oregon and the impact that it would have on tribal facilities and the ultimate impact that it would have on those tribal government programs that I just mentioned. So we think it's a wonderful idea. As all of you know, and you've heard me say many, many a time, Oregon really is unique when it comes to the relationship between the state and tribes. From Governor Vic Atiyah, who actually established the Commission on Indian Services, through to Governor John Kitzhaber, who came up with Executive Order 9630, to the Oregon Legislature that passed Senate Bill 770 to put that executive order into statute, Oregon is second to none when it comes to government-to-government relationships and that unique relationship with tribes. We feel that Senate Bill 18 is a continuance of that, and it is something that gives all Oregonians a true measure of what the economic impact through the initiative process would be on tribes. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much again for this opportunity, and we urge your support of Senate Bill 18.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I see none.
Great. Thank you.
Are we ready to go? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18 and open a work session on Senate Bill 18.
And just for the record, members, this measure has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. There was no statement issued.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 18 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves Senate Bill 18 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion passes. Senate Bill 18 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 18. Colleagues, we have notice for work session, House Bill 3113. We're not going to do that today. Just to remind you, that's the bill we heard dealing with ballot envelopes and notices. I'd like to continue the discussion of that issue, but I have another proposal I'd like to bring to the committee, so we will put that off for a future date. Last item is possible introduction of committee measures.
Do I have to gavel that?
Yes, you do. And members, you have LC 3863. It's relating to ballots and requires certain statements relating to effective state initiatives on revenues and expenditures of public monies to appear on ballot titles and envelopes containing ballot titles.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3863, relating to ballots.
Vice Chair Hicks moves that LC 3863 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, Motion passes. The measure is introduced as a committee bill. No further business before the committee. We are adjourned. Thank you.